to my eyes or slumber to my eyelids, till I find a place for the Lord, a dwelling for the Mighty One of Jacob. We heard it in Ephrathah. We came upon it in the fields of Jar. Let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool, saying, Arise, Lord, and come to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. May your priests be clothed with your righteousness. May your faithful people sing for joy. For the sake of your servant David, do not reject your anointed one. The Lord swore an oath to David, a sure oath he will not revoke. One of your own descendants I will place on your throne. If your sons keep my covenant and the statutes, teach them then. Their sons shall sit on your throne for ever and ever. For the Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his dwelling, saying, This is my resting place for ever and ever. Here I will sit enthroned, for I have desired it. I will bless her with abundant provisions. Her poor I will satisfy with food. I will clothe her priests with salvation, and her faithful people shall ever sing for joy. Here I will make a horn grow for David and set up a lamp for my anointed one. I will clothe his enemies with shame, but his head shall be adorned with a radiant crown. Thanks be for God for this reading.
The second reading is taken from Nehemiah. It's chapter 1, page 484. Nehemiah chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you, day and night, for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. Thanks be to God for this reading. Thank you.
So, Father, we pray that your Spirit may be upon us in this speaking from your word, that we may hear what you would say to us, that our hearts may be open to receiving it, and our wills shaped, that we may follow you all our days. Amen. Well, I've been asked by the PCC to take a break from our series on Christian life in the workplace for a week and share with you a reflection from Nehemiah chapter 1, part of which I did give to the men's breakfast 2 Mondays ago, and then gave it again on the Friday to the PCC, because it had morphed in that week as a result of the conversation that the men had after I had shared the reflection with them. And it kind of morphed into something very apposite about what we're trying to do in buying this building. And so, having shared it with the PCC, they said, tell it to the church as soon as possible. So here we are. And what we're not doing is dealing with the boss, it occurs to me very much so, this is about Nehemiah's preparation to deal with his boss in all that follows on in the following chapters of the book. Now, when people ask about, when you ask people about Nehemiah, they will say, oh yes, he's the one who built the walls. He's the one who rebuilt the city of Jerusalem after the disaster of the exile. And he did it against opposition and all of that. And yes, that's true. But what makes this reflection pertinent is that I believe Nehemiah, before he did those things, had to have his own walls, the walls, his inner walls of his life, broken down. Verse 1 says he was in the citadel of Susa, at the royal stronghold. But he was also in a citadel of his own comfort, in his own heart. And he had to be deconstructed before he could do what needed to be done. So let's remind ourselves then of when we are talking about and what the circumstances were. So the year 586, the people of Israel had been carried off into exile 800 miles away into Babylon by the tyrannical King Nebuchadnezzar. Thank you. I thought nobody knew. King Nebuchadnezzar. And we know that old song, don't we? By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept. They wept when they remembered Zion, when they remembered Jerusalem, their home, when they remembered their temple and their God. They were in captivity in Babylon for 48 years until the Babylonians were overcome by the Persians, a king called Cyrus the Persian. He took power, and his policy was to send the captives back to their homelands. And that's where they could live in peace under his rule. That was the idea. He thought it was better to treat them in that manner. So he gave them permission. And in 358, some of the Jews from Babylon came back to Jerusalem and began to build the temple. Zerubbabel and Haggai and the other one. You know, they built that. They went on building the temple there, and a rough hewn thing compared to the glories that it had been, but they had begun to build it. And when they'd done that, they started a little bit on the city wall. But there is local opposition. It's no surprise, is it? Israel is always surrounded by local opposition and enemies to this day. There was the hated Samaritans to the north, and there were the Edomites to the east and the Moabites to the south. all of them against Israel. And they were splitters, really. They're informers, telltale liars. And they wrote successive letters to the kings of Persia, to the following kings, to Darius and Xerxes and Artaxerxes. And they were telling them that this city of Jerusalem is an uppity city, and that they would live to regret it if they allowed this building to go on. The city would rebel against them and there would be trouble. And so, stop, start, they managed to get this bit of a temple sorted. But Artaxerxes I stopped the wall building. No wall building of any kind could take place. So Nehemiah had never been to Jerusalem. His grandfather had been carried off in the exile under Nebuchadnezzar. And his grandfather had a son called Hechaliah, and Hechaliah had Nehemiah. So Nehemiah grew up as a second generation exile. Born and bred in Babylon, he knew the local culture. He spoke the local language with a local dialect, with his local accent. And he worked his way up the civil service of his country until, as we read in verse 11, he was cupbearer to the king. A great and high honour, a Jew in the Persian king's palace in Susa. Now, to be a cupbearer to the king is not a menial task. To be cupbearer to the king means literally you have his ear. As you offer the cup balanced on the three fingers of the right hand and steadied with the left hand, you lean forward and you can whisper in his ear secret information you want the king to know. It's a place of trust. You're the gatekeeper to the king. You're his confidant, his friend, his advisor. Advising on significant imperial matters. Nehemiah was the Alistair Campbell of his day. That's who he was. And this is where it begins to get interesting as a story. Because Nehemiah, prominent in the halls of power, meets some people in verse 2 who come from Jerusalem. Hanani, one of my brothers, and some other men. But brothers by blood, by race, if not by blood. And Nehemiah questions them about the people back in Jerusalem, those who've survived the exile. And what's it like in the city itself? How are the people? What's the state that the city's in? So here's Nehemiah, born in Babylonia, at the heart of power in the royal city of Susa, knowing the customs and the culture of the place where he lived, serving the king, serving the royal city, but his heart was for another city. Another kingdom. You see, his heart was for a different story. He was living a different story to the story of his life so far. He was more interested in the great story of the people of God. And that, I think, is the first challenge to us. That we have in our day to achieve the dream of owning Meadgate Church, owning this building, we have to know and live by a different story. A story that tells us where we're from and where we're going. A story that tells us what is our peace and our purpose. A story that tells us where we belong, what we believe, and who will fight for us. As the Book of Common Prayer says, Lord, save thy people, bless thine inheritance, give peace in our time, because there is none other that fighteth for us but only thou, O God. We claim the language of that story every week. We speak the words of faith and hope in Jesus Christ. But then there comes a time when we're challenged to really live by the story. A way that costs us something. Some of you, I know, have been concerned about the amount of money per adult head that has been talked about in the church. And there's been work going on about how that might be resourced and found and so on. That work is ongoing. Others have expressed concern about jeopardizing future security or taking loans from drawing on a pension. Well, no one should go into unmanageable debt. No one should give more than they want to. But everyone who is living this story ought to think about what they can give. And if you can't give anything, you can give your prayers. You can share in the struggle of the prayer that is so necessary to achieve the dream that God has been laying on our hearts. Well, the news for Nehemiah, it's not good news. Verse 3 says that the people are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, its gates are burned. And the news comes by a letter, as a consequence of a letter. You can read the letter for yourself in Ezra chapter 4. It's written by King Artaxerxes, stopping the work on the wall. Now, here's the thing. It's Nehemiah's boss who's written this letter. The one who Nehemiah talks in the ear of. Nehemiah advises him on policy throughout the empire. And it's where Nehemiah's world begins to crumble. Because Nehemiah finds himself knowingly or unknowingly, directly or indirectly, implicated in the oppression of his own people. He's part of the power structure that is preventing the story of God's people from being worked out. It's a disaster. And it's a disaster not only for the city, but it's a disaster for Nehemiah personally. A disaster for him culturally, because he is a Jew. A disaster for him religiously, because Jerusalem is where God's place is. It's a disaster for him emotionally, because he, in part, is responsible for it. And he cares about it. He cares about it. Verse 3 says, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. Nehemiah cares so much that he wants to make a difference. And we will care. We will care if we want to make a difference here. If we're going to see God's city established in this place, we too will care enough in our prayer and in our provision to see it happen. Our news is different from Nehemiah's news. Our news is joyful news. Rejoice, we said, because the council have listened to us. They are willing to sell us this building for £650,000. Probably £2 million cheaper than they could sell it off on market. Rejoice, we said. But if we care, then our joy has to be as intense as Nehemiah's sadness. when he got the news of Jerusalem. We have to have such an intensity that we can do this against the odds. We must match Nehemiah's weeping in our joy. And then there's the muse. He muses over it for 4 months. Verse 1 says, he hears the news in the month of Kislev. That's November going on to December. And then at the beginning of chapter 2, in the month of Nisan, that's March going on to April, he goes to see the king about it. 4 months of prayer and musing over the situation. 4 months, that's about as long as we've got, as long as the council have given us to work this purchase through. And it's an earnest prayer. If it were me, the prayer would be, "Oh God, the walls, do something." And that would be it. Because my prayers are often like that. That's how they go. Simple, cost-free prayers. "Oh God, the walls, do something." I pray that about so many things. Never getting to the nitty-gritty. Never getting to the earnestness of it. Never getting down to what it really means to be praying with God about things that are beyond me. But Nehemiah spends quantity and quality time at it. In verse 6 he says, "Let your ear be open to hear the prayer of your servant praying before you day and night." He goes on and on and on, day and night, for 4 months in his prayers about the circumstance of the city. Now, our AGM said, didn't we, that we should go on and survey this building, which we've had done, or is in the process of what's almost done. It's another little one to be done. And to see what we can raise in terms of cash before we decide finally, definitively, whether we should go ahead to buy the building. And the PCC, Friday week ago, set the 24th of June as the date. It's a Sunday when we may come here earlier in the morning as usual to worship and then have some breakfast and spend some time together before we go back to worship and prayer and then have some lunch. And then we'll have another bit of time of worship before we build up to the hour of gift at 3 o'clock, or at least pledging at 3 o'clock. Because at 3 o'clock at the temple, that was when the evening sacrifice happened. That was when Jesus died at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That seems to me to be a good time to follow in the ancient tradition and make a 3 o'clock evening sacrifice to the Lord. So we set that day aside. And that means that we haven't got 4 months, we've got 4 weeks to pray about what our own contribution can be. Wouldn't it be great if we, like Nehemiah, could offer night and day prayer for 4 weeks? Prayer that seeks God's plans and purposes. A prayer that seeks God's power and provision. A prayer that plants the seed and the passion for what God calls us to do. Wouldn't it be great if there were people amongst us today who'll say, "I'll convene a prayer meeting, I'll lead a prayer session," and they set the time and the day or the night when we can drop in and go again, knowing that others will drop in later on, and keep the prayer going because they want this vision to come true? Wouldn't it be great if all of us could give ourselves for the next 4 weeks to night and day prayer about this opportunity to build God's house here? And if you want to know how to pray, I can tell you it's in Nehemiah's prayer. in which he did three things. Firstly, Nehemiah's prayer created faith. He gets on his knees and he does business with God. Sorry, I've gone too far on. Firstly, it creates faith. It's the prayer in verse 5 to Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God, we've sung this already, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commands. It's not a prayer to the private, personal, me and my Jesus God. It's a prayer to the God of heaven. The great and awesome God. The God worth putting our faith in because he's able. Don't get me wrong, Jesus, I don't misinterpret what I just said about the me and my Jesus God, but you know what I mean. It's more than the personal. It's the God who is able. The God who is willing, who's powerful, who's consistent, who's faithful. See, this is quality faith. Putting our faith not for something, but in someone. Not a quantity of faith that says that if we can just muster up enough faith, then we can do this thing. But a quality of faith that says, my God is great and awesome and he is able. The prayer creates faith because it focuses on God. It brings us back to God and it reminds us of who he is and what he is. So let the prayer create faith. Secondly, it cleanses the conscience. This is where Nehemiah gets on his knees and he does the business with God. It recognizes the failings of the people and he includes himself in it. Verse 6 and 7, we have acted wickedly, he says. We have not obeyed. And he says, I confess my sins. Sometimes I get up in the morning in these days and I think, we can't do this. I can't do this. I think it's impossible to achieve. And I flip in the day between no and yes. Hope rises and then, oh, it's just too much. And then I think it's not about us. And it's not about what we can do. It's not about me. It's not about my leadership. It's about God and what he can do in and through us. And I need to confess my lack of faith. I need to confess my self-centered thinking and my lily-livered living. And it's the prayer that cleanses the conscience that means I can come back to the great and awesome God who will fight for me. And thirdly, and perhaps mostly, Nehemiah's prayer claims the promise. In verse 8 and 9, he remembers the instructions that were given by God through Moses to obey God's command. And God promises in through that command to gather the exiled people from the farthest places and bring them to the place he had chosen as a dwelling for his name. Could it be that God has chosen this place to be the dwelling for his name? Could it be that the people around who don't yet know that we even exist, how many times do I hear, oh, I didn't know this place was here. It's wonderful, isn't it, they say when they get here. Could it be that those people who don't yet know we're here will be brought from far and wide to be gathered in the years to come because God has chosen this as the place where his name will dwell. And where they will come and encounter him. Remember I spoke yonks ago on Mark chapter 2, I think, where the fella's lowered through the roof in the house. And it begins that story with the whole house was so full because they heard that Jesus was the house. It was in the house. And that we don't come here and invite Jesus here. We come here because Jesus already is here. He's in the house. And when God's in the house, when he's made this place the dwelling for his name, the people will come. Let the prayer claim the promise. Now, this is the point. This is the point of all I've been saying. Nehemiah's prayer went on for 4 months. Because that's the length of time it took to work in his heart. The length of time it took to change him. To let his own inner citadel of comfort be knocked down and dismantled. To place the story of God and his people above his own security, his comfort in the palaces of power. See, what Nehemiah was to do for Jerusalem, God first had to do in the hearts of Nehemiah. Nehemiah himself, having been demolished, had to be rebuilt. And so in the end, Nehemiah chooses to be part of the answer to his own prayer. In fact, if you read on, you see that he's prepared to put his own life on the line by being sad in the presence of the king. He's prepared to give up his position of power, to step fully into the story of God that he has heard about so often and talked about and dwelt upon through his life. He steps right into that story, and we're still talking about it now. I can't tell you what to do about the orchards. And I don't know if we can achieve it. But I know that there is a story that we can be part of. And there's a prayer that we can enter into. And that if we pray day and night about the challenges we face, we may find that God works in us, breaking down our citadels of comfort, tearing down our walls of resistance. And when he does that, by his working in us and through us, we will become the answer to our own prayers. Amen.